Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm Matt Shawley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, it's PMQs Unpacked, but MPs are away for recess. So it's a classic PMQs Unpacked. Patrick McGuire and I go back to January 1997 to pause the action as John Major and Tony Blair go at it. We'll do the best of the rest as well. Before that, the columnists today, Robert Crampton and Jane Merrick, on just how bad will the in-tray be if Labour form the next government. If you like what you hear on the podcast, don't forget, you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. And it's a busy day for news. So many questions being asked today. Why is satisfaction with the NHS slumping? Why are the rivers full of Why are so many Tory ministers quitting? Why hasn't the army got more money? So many questions, so many questions. And we can go straight to Rishi Sunak for all of his answers.
So it probably wouldn't be right for me to comment on individual suppliers. Again, you would not expect me to comment on the use of those powers. Again, it wouldn't be right for me to comment on individual companies. Again, these are commercial things. You wouldn't expect me to comment on them. I just refer back to the earlier comments.
I'm glad we cleared that up. In fact, the one thing the Prime Minister was willing to comment on at the liaison committee yesterday was this question from Tory MP William Ragg.
Is there a deep state? Or are you part of it? Am I part of it?
I probably wouldn't tell you if I was.
So yeah, he still won't confirm. Is he part of the deep state that brought down Liz Truss? Anyway, onwards and upwards, onwards and upwards. Had a great night last night in Cambridge. Doing a pole dancer show in Cambridge last night. Popped in for a cup of tea with Catherine Barnard, who is a highly respected professor of European law at Cambridge University, but you may remember as being our sausage correspondent, who spent 3 years explaining why you couldn't get a sausage into Northern Ireland. We had a nice tour of Trinity College, which was nice. And then during the show last night, once again, focus group the room, people suggested things they wanted to do, and then they voted, and Cambridge voted, to impose a £1 million fine on firms who misuse the phrase, we are experiencing a higher than usual number of calls. It's all a COVID thing, isn't it? Anyway, that would prove very popular. And then, very excitedly, in the middle of the show, some breaking news, nominated for an award.
I've been nominated for an award.
Is the Arias, which is like the Oscars of the... Although everything's on the Oscars, you know, you've got the estate agents, the Oscars for the estate agents.
So, in the nominations, Dan Snow from the History Hits, don't know who that is, Hugo Rifkin from something called Times Radio, Jake Boswell from Flaner Productions, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover from Times Radio, Jeremy Vine from Radio 2. Don't cheer Jane and Fee. I'm literally here. Josh Baker from 5 Live, Marianne Spring from Radio 4, Matt Shawley from Times Radio, and Zach and Jules from Life After Prison. So that means I am at least the ninth best presenter in
Although, if Jane and Fee and Zach and Jules count separately, I am at least the 11th best presenter. That's what I mean.
The Columnists.
And we are joined, as we always are on a Wednesday morning, by Robert Crampton. Hello, Robert Crampton.
Hello, Matt Chorley.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, I'm all right.
We're Alice Thompsonless.
Yeah, Easter, isn't it?
Easter.
It should be on the farm, should think.
I should think so.
Yeah.
Slaughtering some baby lambs.
Slaughtering something. Yeah. Planting something. Is it slaughter? No, it's slaughtering time, isn't it?
Slaughtering time.
Yeah. The Easter roast.
Let's know what you're slaughtering. 0333 003 2353. So instead, we are joined from the Eye by Jane Merrick. Hello, Jane.
Hello.
What are you going to be slaughtering this Easter?
an Easter egg hunt, probably very badly organised.
Now, you're on the subject of planting. What should we be planting right now? You're very green fingered.
Oh, I've got my broad beans in pots, which are coming through. So they're going to be planted out when the soil is warm enough, probably in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I've only just started chitting my potatoes. Have I left it a bit late?
No, you're fine. It's quite a cold March anyway. So,
it is.
You know.
Yeah, it was freezing this morning. Worried about my tulips.
Oh, thank goodness for that.
They'll be fine.
Thanks.
Good.
Thank you, Jane. Very reassuring.
Anyway, thanks, Jane. Bye bye. That was gardening with Jay Mo. So we should talk about the latest crisis to beset Rishi Sunak. It's so telling, I think, of the state of the issue that two ministers quit on the same day, and it only makes page 8 of the Times.
I saw that yesterday, and I thought, oh, well, that's our front page sort of.
Yeah.
But actually, some people with better judgment than me decided, no, it's not really a big deal.
I mean, Jay, there's a very real possibility we might get to the election. There might not be a government left. It's going to be sort of game of musical chairs. Just Rishi Sunak left, running around the chairs, trying to be the whole cabinet on his own.
Yeah, I mean, can we just have a moment to say it's great to see Alan Mack back in government? Yeah, He's got a ministerial job again. Yeah. But I think it's interesting because it is obviously, I mean, it's not quite Boris Johnson summer resignation level, you know, just putting it in any old backbencher to fill a government. But it is slightly reminiscent of that, and it does feel a bit like a government in decay. Mm. I mean, the thing about Robert Halfen and James Heapey is that they were really good ministers. They really knew their subjects. James Heapey was Armed Forces Minister since the last election. You know, they really knew the things. And it's a shame, it's a pity, I think, for those two sectors that we've lost those before the election. And I wonder whether, I mean, I don't know whether, what their plans are, but I wonder whether we'll see ministers, because of sort of a COBRA rules of getting a new job.
Yeah.
They know that they're standing down after the election. 6 months, probably, you have to have a gap between your job and getting a job in the private sector. Whether a lot of these people are starting to think ahead to life after Parliament and after government. So they're now quitting so that they can have that 6 month gap.
Yeah, I mean, I think it might have been Yes Minister where they said if you've got, say, 350 MPs and therefore a majority, if you knock out the ones who don't want to be ministers and the ones who are drunks and the ones who are mad and the ones who are kind of deviant in some way, corrupt, you have to find 100 people to fill the government, the cabinet and the junior roles. And they were long exhausted, weren't they? Long exhausted. And as Jane said, I mean, I don't know James Heapey, but I know he's got a good reputation. I knew Robert Halfen slightly, interviewed him many years ago before he was an MP, actually. And he's an impressive man and a good minister. And it's a loss when people like that, I mean, the calibre is pretty low. And if the good people, the few remaining good people are going, then, you know, who's going to be running the country for the next 6 months?
And I suppose it's really hard for Rishi Sunak to present, you know, we've got new ideas, we've got fresh, you know, if all the people, you know, if around him, everyone's just putting it's like on BBC News when they're reading the news and behind them, everyone's putting their high-vis jackets on and heading out the door.
Last person to leave, please switch the lights off. Yeah. I mean, it does feel like that.
Well, we'll see if there are any more. There might be some more before we finish speaking. But I want to turn my attention to, so if, you know, if the polls are being believed, Labour 25 points ahead in the polls, Rishi Sunak on the way out. And then you think, and then you go, literally going through the Times today, just 1 in 4 say the NHS is working. A row over freeholds. And then you turn the page again There's splits over what to do about China. That, you know, is there any money to be saved in public services? Weather blame for record discharge of raw sewage last year.
Roads.
The airports aren't working.
The roads covered in litter.
The roads are covered in litter.
And potholes. The potholes are full of litter.
The court talking about getting rid of trials by jury just to try and get through the enormous backlog. And you think, it's an enormous in-tray which will be awaiting an incoming government. Do you get the sense, Robert, that Labour have got any idea what to do about any of those things?
Not really, no. I mean, I think it's... Obviously, their tactic is, to quote the famous Roy Jenkins phrase about Blair carrying the Ming vase across the polished floor, running the run-up to 97. They're doing a similar version of that. The problem with that is that if you get in and you haven't told the people what they're voting for, you haven't really got a mandate. And when you hit trouble, as they will instantly, things become difficult, especially if you haven't got a sort of a kind of abiding set of core principles. You've got the energy, I guess, compared to this current lot, which is good. And you've got some idealism, but you haven't got any experience.
Yeah.
I haven't been in government. Is there anybody there who's been a minister? I don't think. Not many.
Yvette Cooper,
Pat McFadden, maybe. Yeah. So, no, I don't have a sense that they've got a plan to deal with any of those things that you mentioned.
What do you think, Jane? It is going to be a problem. It actually, because a lot of these things are going to require tough decisions. Either making decisions and then having to explain why you can't tackle all these things immediately, or tough decisions on, for instance, putting up tax. You know, the conversation we've been having about the NHS. You know, if the public services are in trouble because there isn't enough money, well, there's one solution to that, which is putting up tax. But that's they're not going to have a mandate for that, are they, Jane?
No, and actually they're going to have an honest conversation with the electorate, but no one's going to want to vote for, you know, salty porridge. They need a little bit of sugar as well. So you can't just say, but Keir Starmer can't just go, things can only get better, here's some hope. He does have to be realistic, but he also has to set out a proper plan. You know, it's not going to be, you know, oh my God, we're going to transform the NHS overnight. And Wes Streeting has said it's going to take a parliament. But you can't just say, right, it's going to be grim, so you just got to get on with it and put up with us. They need to sort of have, I think as Robert is saying, you know, a concrete plan of here is how we get from A to B, here is how we're going to do it. It is going to cost this money. We're going to have to make sacrifices. I mean, Bridget Phillipson, the Shadow Education Secretary, was on the radio this morning saying that she couldn't even commit to the Tories' childcare plan for government. So what are parents thinking now?
Yeah.
So hang on, we're going to get free childcare for a few months and then we're not sure whether we're going to have it. You know, they have to be honest, but they have to balance it with a little bit of, we are going to vote for something better and here it is.
I have to say, if we get a Tory minister on, you just end up having this conversation, we've been in government for 14 years, why are you, if you get a Labour fund back on, it's even more infuriating because they won't commit to anything. But I've had, Bridget Phillipson, asking what she's going to do about GCSEs and A-levels. And she's like, well, we'll have a review when I'm in government.
That's the strategy, and as a short-term election winning strategy, you can see it makes sense. But it's going to be a really bad, big wake-up call as and when they do win. I mean, it's not just those sort of, what you might call the sort of medium-sized problems that you were talking about. It's the major structural problems in terms of a pension system that we can't afford, a benefit system that we can't really afford anymore, and this elephant in the room that people won't even think about putting up income tax. I mean, other countries have a higher tax burden. The ones with the welfare state that we all admire, Scandinavia and so forth, they have a higher tax burden than we do. We want European welfare with American taxation, don't we? We've got to square that circle.
And the Labour Party, Jane, the Labour Party, you know, keep using the same lines as the Tory right, you know, complaining about the high tax burden rather than saying, well, we need that money to repair the mess that goes, you know, and then they're supporting the cut in national insurance rather than saying, well, we're not sure about that because the public services might need it. And then you've got Wes Streeting responding to this survey, Shadow Health Secretary, saying after 14 years of Conservative neglect, the NHS has now been in a worse state. The last Labour government delivered the highest patient satisfaction in history. We did it before and we'll do it again. It's not clear how. And the big difference, Jane, it was in 1997, they had this golden inheritance. The economy was booming.
Yeah,
they can't just live off the kind of the nostalgia of the 97 to 2010 period. I mean, I say nostalgia, obviously the end of it wasn't very prosperous. They have to give something more than that. And I think voters probably, we shouldn't patronise voters. They would appreciate a bit of honesty. and straight talking. And it just feels inauthentic at the moment that Labour can't quite tell us what their plans are because they're so scared of, you know, losing the election. They're so scared of fighting shy of everything. They're fighting shy of the left. They're fighting shy of the Tories. Just be more authentic and be more honest. And they'll probably win the election anyway. But we know what we're getting into.
It's interesting. Mike's just been in touch saying, I'm not a Labour insider. OK. But any bright new ideas now will just get pinched by the government, see non-doms. And I suppose there is a...
Good point.
There is a problem. Yeah. Actually, part Labour are now having to scale back or at least rethink their original plans because...
Yeah, that was the one thing they had.
The one thing they had to pay for.
But that was only ever going to be fairly marginal, the non-dom thing. It was raising a 3 or 4 billion, I think, wasn't it? I mean, the taxes that matter are income tax, national insurance and VAT. They're the ones, they're the big hitters. And everything else is... slightly rounding errors.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, but I mean, it'd be extraordinary if you saw a Labour or anybody going into a general election talking about putting up income tax. I suppose the Lib Dems did, didn't they, in 97?
Yeah, and also, I mean, Theresa May's 2017 proposal to...
social care.
Yeah, which is popularly credited with losing a majority. Yeah. So you can see why they're fighting shy of it.
Yeah. Right, well, let's move on because there'll be plenty of opportunity to discuss Labour and the Tories in the coming weeks. But, Robert, let's talk about school bullies. Mm. Children who displayed aggressive behaviour at school, such as bullying or temper outbursts, are likely to earn more money in middle age, according to a 5-decade study from the University of Essex. But you weren't sure this was your experience?
No, I mean, it's a valid study. You see a lot of these studies as a columnist because you think you can get a bit of a column out of them. And this one actually looks like a proper one. So it's worth having a look at. It's only 4% more. But my experience was some of the sort of, if you like, second division bullies that I was at school with have done okay and some haven't. But the real kind of Premier League bullies, kind of verging on psychotic, who kind of terrorised pretty much everybody, me included, have done, well, most, they've been in prison, essentially. They were
The boy who revelled in the title of Cock of the East Block.
Cock of the East Block, yeah. I won't quote him. And he just went around he jumped the gun on anyone he thought might be coming up for his title. Yeah. He just attacked them.
Yeah.
Preemptive, that's the word. He ended up in prison. Yeah, then quite soon afterwards, because he got impatient at queuing for a nightclub in town and thought the best way to get the queue moving was to go and stab the bouncer. So he ended up in HMP Hull. So he didn't prosper. And so there were a few, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate, there were a few of these people, but they had a big impact in that time because you are in an institution and you're having to share the same space and time with them. Which doesn't happen often in life.
Yeah.
But then they hit the adult world and the justice system takes over.
Yeah.
I was trying to be positive.
James, does this chime with your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I was bullied at school. I think my bullies were more kind of, it was all more mind games than sort of physical aggression. You know, one of them's working in last I heard, he was working in a cinema. And not talking on Times Radio to you, Matt. So that's so I feel like I've won that little battle.
You've won the lottery.
Well done, Jane.
what's worse, I was bullied by a teacher in primary school, and I think that's so much worse because you feel like, you know, they're the adult in control and absolutely terrible. And it's really interesting. I was reading Robert's column, thinking about, you know, where are they now? I didn't hear anything about this teacher, and obviously I won't name her, but she. I walked into the room and the radio was on and this voice came out, this radio phoning, and it absolutely froze me to the spot because it sounded like her. And it turned out it was her because she said her name. She was calling into a phone-in and she was a retired teacher and she was complaining about her pension. And it absolutely chilled me because she'd done such a powerful job of making me feel pathetic and small. Mm. And, you know, 40-odd years later, it just still chilled me. So, you know, I guess if we're talking about bullies, I mean, if one thing I could say to my 14-year-old self when I was bullied by kids at school is that it's their problem, not yours. You know, when you're bullied, you think that it's your problem, it's your humiliation, it's you're the one who's got the problem, whatever they're picking on you for. And it's not at all. It's their problem. They're the pathetic ones. And they've got their sad little lives. And, you know, maybe they'll prosper, maybe they'll, you know, be a chief executive give, or maybe they'll just end up in prison like Robert's bullies. But I mean, that's, it's really good perspective now, and it's hard to see when you're a child.
And also, it's worth saying, I think, that even the ones who do prosper, perhaps, as this survey was saying, earn a little bit more than the less aggressive people, they're probably not happy.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Who would trade earning 4% more than the average or whatever it is
yeah.
for everybody to dislike you?
Yeah,
and secretly be hating you and hoping you're going to fail. I mean, it's not a decent trade off, is it?
And it's that sort of, you know, being comfortable in your own skin is so much more quite important. And then alongside this story, there's a survey out showing that nearly one in six adolescents have experienced cyberbullying.
Mm.
So it's a big survey they've done right across the UK. One in five in England. So it's 90% in England, 18% so experienced cyberbullying in Scotland, and similar figures in Wales. And I suppose it's probably easier now, isn't it? Because like your classic bully, your Grange Hill bully, like you said, going around nutting people or pushing your head down the toilet. But now you don't need the physical strength or the, you know, you can basically do it vicariously through a phone.
Yeah, you can.
And you don't see the consequences of it. It's basically, it's more cowardly, but has a more devastating impact. Not physically, obviously. If it's stabbing about, it's slightly different to sending a
I mean, a different sort of impact, a wider impact.
Yeah.
And maybe, I mean, sort of mental, emotional bullying is, I guess, in the long run, is probably worse than physical attack, unless it's really serious. I mean, it's sort of mutated into that, hasn't it? For youngsters now, especially, I think teenage girls are particularly can become the victim of this in a way that, I don't know, maybe girls were less victims of the sort of that kind of physical bullying in my day, although there was other types of bullying going on. But this is particularly prey to that. It doesn't go away, but I think it has got better in schools. I think that is a sign, that is a progress, not least because the teachers don't do it anymore. What has been, I mean, a joke, what Jane said, some of the bullies at primary school were teachers, and that is entirely my experience as well. And that, I think, has changed. You're sort of losing your job now.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's great. But the idea that it can, your home is not a safe space anymore, in a way that it was for most people then, that is a change for the worst. And my solution would be to not go on social media. It's really, I can't. I know that sounds crass and say, well, if you're 14, you've got to be on social media for this reason. But if it's really that bad, just come off it.
And in fact, there's this thing in Florida, they've just passed a law trying to stop people going on social media, Jane.
Right, no, I haven't seen that. I mean, just on the cyber thing, absolutely. I mean, I used every day, my bullies were on the 61 bus, and I used to think if I could just get through this bus journey, 37 minutes, counting it down, without being bullied, that's fine. And getting home, you were safe, as Robert says, you were safe. And now there is no hiding from if you're being harassed online. And I think, I mean, I have a 13-year-old daughter and I'm absolutely terrified that she could be sort of contacted online, contacted by on her phone. And I do sort of try to keep quite a close eye on if this is happening. And it is also just actually talking about it. I mean, I never talked about my bullying with my parents, and I wish I had. So I'm saying to her, please share anything that you're experiencing. It's not like I'm going to go down and kind of knock on their door and sort of humiliate you. But please, it is just better to share it. And I know that from experience.
Yeah. Now, we talked about gardening a minute ago, but what are they watching on telly in North Korea? Because state television is censored. Alan Titchmarsh's trousers by blurring his legs in an episode of a showing of Alan Titchmarsh's Golden Secrets. It's for the BBC series. It aired on Korean Central Television on Monday. But his legs were pixelated to obscure the blue denim jeans he was wearing. We're here to explain why. Peter Ward is a North Korea researcher who joins me live now from Seoul. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Matt. It's great to be here. Thank you.
No, it's great to have you with us. What is the problem with blue denim jeans?
This ban on denim jeans in North Korea goes back to at least the early 1990s. It may go back further. Basically, it comes from Kim Jong-il's attempts to rid the country of anti-socialist, decadent Western culture and fashion. which started spreading in the country. So Western fashion and culture really started to spread in the country as it marketized, and as the economy started to hit a really rough patch in the late 80s and early 1990s.
But watching Alan Titchmarsh tending his petunias is not part of that horrible Western culture.
Well, it is. right, exactly, of course. So there are fine lines. Gardening is a universal good, but gardening in your jeans is obviously decadent, capitalist, just something that should be avoided at all costs, and you can go to prison for doing it if you do it in North Korea.
And are we aware of what else gets blurred out similarly in TV shows?
Yeah, so they blur out quite a lot of stuff nowadays. So under Kim Jong-un, there has been a push to sort of enforce and protect state secrets. So they blur out a lot of information related to their missiles and nuclear programs when they have news broadcasts about them. They blur out the faces of officials associated with those programs. On a more sort of mundane or prosaic note, they also blur out the source of their foreign programming. So they often rebroadcast sports shows in North Korea, but they don't have the rights to do so, and they'll blur out the source from which they've taken the broadcast from, because they're usually rebroadcasting.
I mean, they're stealing the Titchmarsh.
Yeah, exactly. They're not paying for the Titchmarsh. Yeah, they're blurring them out.
The
anyway.
BBC shouldn't be selling it to them, certainly. So.
What do you wear in the garden? Will you be rethinking your trousers?
Pretty much what I'm wearing now, actually.
I've got blue jeans
and a check shirt on.
Off to a line dance later.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, I love a line dance. Yeah.
Do you?
I do, actually.
Very decadent.
Yeah, very decadent.
Yeah, too decadent. Yeah.
You'd definitely be blurred out doing that. Yeah. Jane, what do you wear in the garden?
Well, I wear jeans, but they've got to be skinny jeans because you have to tuck them into your wellies and your welly socks. Ooh. So jeans, hard wearing.
Very, very decadent.
Skinny jeans.
What an expert.
I don't know whether the Titchmarsh has skinny jeans or whether he's just got the boot cut.
Does it, when they blur it, does it look like he's now not got any trousers on at all? Because that's pretty decadent.
It doesn't look like blurred legs. Like it doesn't look like they've had to pixelate his under right regions, which would be very different. Thanks for that.
As if life in North Korea isn't bad enough already without being able to see Alan Titchmarsh's jeans.
What is he doing down there?
Yeah.
Peter, lovely to speak to you. Thank you for that. That's Peter Ward there, a North Korea researcher joining us in Seoul. Jane Merrick from the I newspaper. Robert Crabbe, of course, in the Times. You can read Robert in the Times most days of the week if you're lucky.
Mm. Writing about scrunchies today.
Scrunchies?
Yeah, on the fashion pages, yeah.
Are you using...
No, I just noticed just a bit of trend spotting.
Yeah.
One of my little...
One of those academic surveys.
Sidelines, yeah.
They back...
Yeah, they're getting bigger. Scrunchflation, I've called it.
They're getting bigger?
Massive. There's a kind of scrunch wars going on between some of the young women in the office downstairs, and I just thought it was worth noting for the public record.
How many words do you think you can grind out of that?
I just already have done.
Is it today?
Yes, they're all there.
Is that what it is?
450.
450 words on scrunchies.
Ooh.
Jane Merrick from the I, Robert Crampton from the Times. Of course, you can read him with your subscription at thetimes.co.uk. Up next, it's classic PMQs Unpacked as we go back to 1997.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no,
yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off air, the podcast, now available on the Times radio app.
Order! Order! I call Matt Chorley and Patrick Maguire.
Yes, Patrick Maguire is here for a special edition of PMQ's Unpacked. A classic PMQ's Unpacked. How are you, Patrick?
I'm very well, all the better for spending some time 3 decades ago and not in the present day.
We're turning the clock right back. So, yeah, Parliament is on recess. So Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer are doing their own thing. They're not firing their exchanges across the dispatch box. So instead, we're going all the way back to January the 30th, 1997.
I'm not seeking confrontation with the European Union, but some of the proposals of our partners are proposals that I just believe are wrong for this country.
But it is not in Britain's interest to be forever marginalised and without influence in Europe.
Peace is a two-way street. We fulfil our commitments and the Palestinians fulfil their commitments.
The opposition are not primarily concerned with BSE.
Would you eat British beef at the moment?
No.
Why not?
Because it just kills people.
It's an enormous privilege for me to have been invited here to Angola in order to assist the Red Cross in its campaign to ban anti-personal landmines.
Dawn in West London and Harrods owner Mohammed Al-Fayed is waiting for a lady on an elephant.
It's my pleasure to welcome the new spokesperson for Weight Watchers International, Sarah Ferguson, Duchess of York.
I'm looking forward to the election campaign and in due course, it'll be a lot of fun, a lot of fun, a lot of fun, a lot of fun, a lot of fun.
Will it though? Yeah, but back to so it's Thursday, January 30th, 1997. On the front page of the Times today, a new supremo to advise on food safety. A food safety chief appointed by the government in an attempt to restore public confidence after the BSE crisis and other recent health scares. We heard a bit of that a moment ago. Toyota urges Britain to join the euro. The head of the Toyota car company giving a warning that Britain might lose Japanese investment if it decided not to join a single European country currency. I suspect there'll be more on our relationship with Europe. Coming up, Blair bids for more power in party. Tony Blair having the right to appoint cabinet members to the party's ruling body, the National Executive Committee. I'm not sure that's the sort of story that we get on the front these days, Patrick.
Well, if we said Starmer power grab, then maybe.
Maybe. And Los Angeles police on alert as the jury in the O.J. Simpson civil case considered its verdict. So that was what was on the front pages back then, Patrick. Just explain, it's Thursday, January the 30th, crucially, not Wednesday. Why is that?
Well, because one of Tony Blair's first innovations as Prime Minister in terms of parliamentary process was to unite the two 15-minute sessions of Prime Minister's questions that used to happen on a Tuesday and a Thursday into one session on a Wednesday of half an hour, subsequently extended to as long as John Bercow felt like for a period between 2017 and 2019. So you would just have two sessions of about 15 minutes each on the Tuesday and the Thursday. Tony Blair put those two together to minimise the time he would have to spend, or rather concentrate the time he would have to spend preparing to respond to questions in the House.
So against the background of all of that, early 1997, polls showing Labour's lead over the Conservatives at 25 points as the Prime Minister, a former Chancellor, took over from a woman who slightly lost the plot, John Major, Rishi Sunak. It was expected he was likely to rule out an early election, even speculation in January 97 that he might go early and not hang on until May. Of course, he did. But here we go then. We are going back to Thursday, January the 30th, 1997. Historic, classic PMQs Unpacked. The head of the Commons now. Of course, the Speaker, Betty Boothroyd, starting proceedings.
Questions to the Prime Minister, Mr. Jerry Sutcliffe.
Number one, Madam Speaker.
Yeah.
This morning I presided at a meeting of the Cabinet and had meetings with ministerial colleagues and others. In addition to my duties in this House, I shall be having further meetings later today.
So as the Labour MP, Joey Sutcliffe, as is traditional, kicking off, asking for the official engagement of the Prime Minister. And interestingly, John Major saying he's presided over Cabinet. So Cabinet on a Thursday, not on a Tuesday.
Very interesting, isn't it?
Well, is that interesting?
Well, it's mildly interesting.
If you don't find that interesting, the rest of this is going to be really hard work. we'll come back to Joey Sutcliffe because I think he might be one of the best of the rest on the backbenchers. But this is what we're really here for. Let's kick off then. This is Tony Blair, question number one to the Prime Minister John Major on this classic PMQs Unpacked.
Tony Blair.
Madam Speaker, a few weeks ago, the Prime Minister said that it was essential in the national interest that our options remained open on a single currency and that he expected Conservative candidates to stand on that national manifesto. Is that still his expectation of Conservative candidates?
I think the Right Honourable Gentleman, before taking me to task on this, should perhaps talk to the scores of his own MPs that the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Bethnal Green and Stepney, said would oppose his stance.
That's Peter Shaw, the former Minister.
As the Right Honourable Gentleman said, and I quote, I think it's an obligation to be honest with my own electorate, the Right Honourable Gentleman said. But the Right Honourable Gentleman wouldn't understand that. He entered the House on an election address which demanded Britain's withdrawal from the community. Even though, Madam Speaker, he said later, I wasn't actually opposed to membership of the European community. I said within the closed doors of the Labour Party that I disagreed with the policy. Behind closed doors, he says one thing, in public another. Not the politics of conviction, but convenience. Saying anything to get a vote. And that is what he advocates to his candidates.
OK, let's pause it there. So give us the background to this, Patrick. This is an argument about, in the run-up to the election in 97, would Conservative candidates promise to remain open to Britain joining the Euro? John Major wanted to keep his options open, but by this point, a lot of Conservative candidates were saying, I'm opposed. You know, we are the party of saving the pound.
Exactly. And you have Jimmy Goldsmith's referendum party breathing down the necks of Conservative MPs during this point. I mean, I can't remember if it's on the front page or on the page. Around this time, a Tory MP called George Gardner is deselected by his local association and later joins Jimmy Goldsmith's referendum party. So while the big policy question for John Major is, do we join the Euro or not? The party political question is, I will never be able to shepherd Tory MPs into a position where they do that. Much like with the problem David Cameron later had with an EU referendum. Once that option was on the table, lots of them, scared of UKIP or out of ideological conviction, made the decision to back Brexit despite what the Prime Minister was saying. And it's interesting, John Major's defence there is to employ the same sort of lines we now hear about Keir Starmer. So you say one thing to the Labour Party, you said this when you were elected in 1983, now you're saying another, we can't possibly trust you.
And what's so interesting from a historical perspective, this you know, for younger listeners, John Major there pointed out that Tony Blair, when elected in 1983, he came in the election, which was a landslide for Margaret Thatcher, but Michael Foot's manifesto opposed Britain's membership of the European community. Tony Blair was elected on the promise of taking Britain out of Europe. And given what we know now about Tony Blair, and he wanted to go into the single currency and the face of the Remain campaign and so on, and his defence for that was, I wasn't actually opposed to membership of the European Commission. I said that within the closed doors of the Labour Party, I disagree with that policy.
That's exactly what Keir Starmer says about Jeremy Corbyn
exactly.
And anti-Semitism. Yeah. And it's also very interesting to hear John Major cite Peter Shaw. Now, Peter Shaw, more or less forgotten by mainstream politics, was a very idiosyncratic, big Labour figure in the 70s and 80s who had a very sort of unique pro-NATO, anti-EU, sort of very distinctive politics. It's a Labour tradition that's basically died. But it's very interesting. We'll see a little bit more of this from John Major, I'm sure, to have party grandees thrown at Tony Blair, and also Labour Brexiteers on the left, broadly speaking, on the left of the Labour Party, or on the sort of on the old right of the Labour Party, so to Tony Blair's left. Too many directions here. But basically, to have sort of not extremist but eccentric figures in the Labour firmament in a very message disciplined time saying, well, hang on, Tony, you say this and Alistair Campbell tells all of your MPs to say this, but look at all these people on the fringe of the Labour Party saying other things, and that's something we still see today too.
And what's so interesting about this exchange is the, you know, the perception that Tony Blair was the guy who could walk on water, everyone was fully behind him, you know, he didn't even have his own MPs fully behind him, while John Major was this sort of slightly joke figure. Yeah, you know, I think it's fair to say, yeah, if you just analysed that exchange, John Major came out on top on that one.
Yeah, completely.
So let's find out what happens now. Remember, only three questions from the Leader of the Opposition. So let's go back to the House of Commons on this classic PMQs Unpacked. This is question two from Tony Blair.
Madam Speaker, the Labour Party put its manifesto to its membership and got 95% support. I doubt that he could put his manifesto to his cabinet and get 95% support. After all, I was only asking him to agree with what he himself said a few weeks ago. Well, if he can't say that he now expects Conservative candidates to do that, has he still the vestige of authority and courage left to stand at that dispatch box and say now that at least he strongly urges and seeks to persuade Conservative candidates to stand on his and the government's position?
The Right Honourable Gentleman is just being plain silly. Is he telling this House that the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Honourable Member for Bolsover, the Right Honourable
Dennis
Gentleman
Skinner,
for Chesterfield, the Honourable
Tony
Gentleman
Benn,
for Newham are actually going
Nigel
to support
Spearing
his policy on Europe at the general election? He raises it on this day of all days. The first two Labour questioners on the order paper are both amongst the 50 who say we should not join a single currency. He may ask his candidates to fib to the electorate. Our candidates will set out their views. We will follow the policy that the government have set out. And people know our policy. What he's trying to do is to censor and smother what his party stands for.
It's pretty feisty, this. I mean, first of all, I'm going to say, Patrick Guire, an almost incomprehensible question from Tony Blair. I mean, you so much assumed not. I mean, we're so far away from clipping for social media. I mean, it is sort of a question, but it's a bit sort of, it's quite in the weeds on this question of whether or not Conservative candidates will have to sign up to the position of the Prime Minister.
Which is to at least be open to the single currency. It's not even to endorse single currency. And Tony Blair is now asking him to say, well, if you cannot guarantee that your candidates will endorse your policy of being open to the single currency, can you at least say you'll try to persuade them?
Yeah.
Which, you know, John Major doesn't go on to do. But what makes this quite such a feisty and satisfying exchange, listening now, as two people who listen to PMQs every week, is that both of them know exactly the attack line they want to land.
Yeah.
Tony Blair's can be summed up in one word, weak. He's basically saying John Major is being pushed around and bullied by his party, whereas Tony Blair has taken control of his. John Major, on the other hand, is saying Tony Blair is being fundamentally mendacious, he's lying, and that he has more in common with, and that he doesn't really control his party, and that he is not being honest about his political intentions.
And actually, you could take that and superimpose it on the PMQs that we have every week with Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer, and it would be all the better for it. Neither of them can quite work out what their attack is on the other. You know, Rishi Sunak can't work out, is Keir Starmer a socialist danger who's going to, you know, nationalise the nation and put us all into debt? Or is he someone who doesn't have a plan? You can't both have a plan to turn us into Venezuela and not have a plan. And similarly, the Labour Party can't quite work out where it is on Rishi Sunak. Is he sort of a dangerous right winger? Is he somebody who doesn't keep his promises? Is he weak? And they haven't quite sort of landed on that.
No, exactly. And I also, conversely, neither have number 10 on Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
But it just goes to show, and that is something Tony Blair himself said. That's how Tony Blair used PMQs. to define and test out attack lines against his rivals. And that's the one purpose it served. But I don't think either Keir Starmer or Rishi Sunak have perfected that one word. You know, Tony Blair would say Major was weak, William Hague was good on jokes, but terrible on substance, yeah, et cetera, et cetera.
OK, but here we go. This is the last exchange from the front benches, anyway. This is question number three on classic PMQs Unpacked. We go back to the Commons. Question three from Tony Blair.
I asked him two questions. I said, as he himself said a few weeks ago, does he expect them to stand on the same manifesto? I answer it, yes. I then asked him, will he at least seek to persuade people to stand on the same manifesto? I answer, yes. He is so weak and powerless, he can't even say. I mean, well, is it not weak? He cannot even get to that. Oh, yes. Yeah. Is it not extraordinary?
Order! Order!
Oh, better both words up.
Come to order.
Extraordinary. Isn't it extraordinary that the Prime Minister of our country can't even urge his party to support his own position?
Yeah.
Yeah. Weak, weak, weak. Yeah. Yeah. Weak. I tell him, that is the reason. His weakness and his failure of leadership are the reason his government is the incompetent mess it is.
Whenever the Right Honourable Gentleman gets abusive, we know he's losing. We know he's losing. If he is concerned about strength, will he today sack the Honourable Member for Oldham East, who yesterday contradicted what he said about tax?
That's Michael Meacher.
Will he today sack the Deputy Chief Whip of the Labour Party, who yesterday contradicted what it was said about tax? All he does is heckle and waft his arms around in a hopeless gesture. Yes or no? Will he sack them or not? His policy, they are members of his shadow cabinet. They have denied his policy. We have set out consistently what our policy is. I have said it is important to keep the options, all of the options open, all of the options open. The Honourable Gentleman sniggers, I'm quoting his words, not mine. Keep all of the options open. He has followed in grandmother's footsteps in following policy after policy of ours. He says we should keep the options open. We keep the options open, but his policy apparently means something quite different because he dare not admit what his policy is.
And then it all kicks off a bit. So the reason we've chosen this PMQs is because it's the weak, 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 weak one, it turns out. There's a fourth week that often gets cut out of the soundbite. So it's famous for that. And, you know, it's a defining moment where Tony Blair, you know, tied up John Major and put a bow on it. Actually, this is more evenly balanced.
John Major definitely gives as good as he gets. That's certainly true. And Tony Blair doesn't really have any rejoinder to any of the questions. I mean, let's zero in on the mention of Michael Meacher, who was a shadow cabinet minister, who would have been destined for the cabinet, but in 1997 or late 1996, I can't remember which, around the time of this PMQ, indeed the day before, Michael Meacher said, look, Gordon Brown said we're not going to raise taxes on personal income, but there's certainly lots of other taxes we can raise. Michael Meacher was then not put in the cabinet, right? That shows you that the attacks John Major was making did wound Tony Blair. This is exactly the stuff Tony Blair and Gordon Brown worried about, the things that John Major is highlighting here. So this idea that, you know, Tony Blair was running rings around John Major all the time isn't necessarily true. And it maybe goes to show how, you know, if you read some of the coverage from the time, it's easy to laugh at in hindsight because it's all sort of, are the polls wrong? You know, will the people who say they don't know return to the Tories? Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell and others were terrified and didn't really believe that they could win the sort of landslide that was projected. And you can sort of understand, listening to the day-to-day politics here, John Major has a coherent and wounding attack on the Labour Party here.
Do you know what grandmother's footsteps are?
The isn't.
It seems to be like an old game, like a children's game.
Is it not where you stand on the, if you're a kid and you stand on the feet of your parent?
Oh, when you do that?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just guessing.
There's a, online, it's a game where one person's grandmother or grandfather and they stand with their back to the class. Everyone else has to sneak up on them and try and touch them. The grandparent could turn around with it. That's a bit like, what's the time, Mr. Wolf, wasn't it? But I don't know what he means doesn't by really he's work. Followed in grandmother's footsteps. But again, in following policy after policy of ours. And then again, the parallels with today, where the Tories accused Labour of nicking their policies, Labour accused the Tories of nicking their policies, and so on. But again, you know, going right to the heart of leadership. And maybe, I suppose, a reminder that actually, even if Rishi Sunak was doing very well at PMQs, it might not actually make any difference to the overall outcome of the
well, indeed, election. William Hague won countless sessions of PMQs, and at the end of that parliament, the Bank of England was still independent and Britain still had a national minimum wage, because if you win at PMQs, it doesn't necessarily mean you win an election.
Yeah, and actually, you know, and maybe because over the next couple of weeks there isn't PMQs, so maybe we can revisit a William Hague, Tony Blair one to see how well he did. Right, let's do the best of the rest then, as we always do with PMQs Unpacked. No PMQs this week because Rishi Sunak, Keir Starmer and the rest of them, they're all on recess, working hard in their constituencies, I'm sure.
Henry Zethman has just been in touch, by the way, to say he used to play grandma's footsteps in the playground.
Well, there we are.
Maybe it's a London thing, he says.
That's BBC's Henry Zethman listening to Times Radio. Morning, Henry. Right. let's. So we're doing classic PMQs. This is from Thursday, January 30th, 1997. We've had the key exchanges from Tony Blair and John Major. Let's go now to a backbench question. Well, I don't know what this guy's first name is. Ashby. What's his name? David Ashby. Let's go to the comments. David Ashby.
Has my right honourable friend seen the statement? Has my right honourable friend seen...
Order! If anyone has been abusive, they will indicate it to me. Order! I think there are a lot of members of this House that have got a good deal of pre-election tension. Let us get on with question time. There are members I want to call. Ashby.
Talkative speaker, not a new thing.
My right honourable friend has undoubtedly seen the statement of the chairman of Toyota. Does my right honourable friend not agree that Toyota came to this country because this my honourable right honourable friend's policies provided the most favourable climate for companies such as Toyota to have a gateway into Europe? Does not his statement show that it is important that we should maintain that gateway and important that we should maintain our foot in Europe so that we get increased investment?
John Major.
We intend to maintain our voice in Europe. There should be absolutely no doubt about that. What we do not intend to do is to slavishly follow whatever might happen to be the favoured policy of some European governments at any particular point in time. We are not going to follow policies that would be damaging to British interests. We are not going to sign social chapters. The deputy leader's back here scoffing as usual. I will tell the deputy leader of the Labour Party,
John Prescott,
one signature on the social chapter will mean 500,000 signatures on the dole.
So there we are. That was a question from David Ashby, the Conservative MP for North West Leicestershire. Now, of course, represented by
Andrew Bridgen.
Andrew Bridgen. So lucky them. Now, the reason this exchange is so interesting is because it's 1997. It would be 20 years before Britain, or a bit less, before Britain would vote to leave the EU. But you can see the seeds being sown then, this debate about Britain's place in Europe. Toyota... it was on the front of the Times that day. The boss of Toyota saying Britain must join the single currency, join the euro, or risk losing Japanese investment. We then had all those arguments again in the run up to the referendum.
With Nissan and Sunderland,
yeah.
And it's this sort of argument that's rehearsed time and time and again. And you see the outsized role of the manufacturing industry, particularly car manufacturers, in determining how politicians talk about and conceive of Britain's relationship with Europe. Remember too, David Davis in 2017 saying, don't worry, all of the German car manufacturers will be knocking on Angela Merkel's, Merkel's door and then we'll get a fantastic deal. And also, you can understand, if you're a Eurosceptic listening to this and you hear Nigel Ashby there saying, you know, we need to have the most favourable possible trading relationship with Europe. You read the front page of the following day's Times, chairman of Tory saying, look, it would be a terrible idea if Britain didn't join the euro and would really jeopardise our presence here. And you see, look, the British car industry isn't what it was, but there's a lot of inward investment into the British car industry at the moment. You can understand why Eurosceptics reading that would say, well, hang on, we've had all of these doomsaying predictions before about not joining the euro, about leaving the EU, about leaving the single market. You know, it happens again and again and again. Look, we've still got a car industry in this country. So it's interesting tracing some of these arguments and the apocalyptic predictions not having come to pass.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's go back to the House of Commons. Classic PMQs unpacked. We're going to Labour MP Jerry Sutcliffe.
Mr. Speaker, I wonder if the Prime Minister is aware of the reports today that the National Health Service is in near collapse in the northwest of England.
Oh, and everywhere else.
Bed shortages, people waiting on trolleys. And could I also say to him that he's in crisis in Bradford as well. 289 operations cancelled in the last quarter. A much needed accident emergency unit we were promised but not delivered after so many years. And we have the outrage of two new mixed sex wards. Two new mixed sex wards that the Prime Minister said would not happen. Isn't the truth that there's two health services, like there's two Tory parties? A health service, a real health service, that's near collapse. And a fantasy health service that the Prime Minister talks about in the press.
Tell us about Fantasyland, says Dennis Skinner.
Well, if the Honourable Gentleman waits a moment, you'll hear what I have to say about it. The Honourable Gentleman referred to the Northwest in his question. He might perhaps have begun by acknowledging the brand new 2.9 million extension to the A&E department at the Royal Liverpool Hospital, opened just a year or so ago, which makes it one of the finest A&E hospitals departments in the country. He shakes his head. He doesn't think it's one of the finest. I do, Madam Speaker. I think it's one of the finest. The demand for the National Health Service is rising, and so is the capacity to meet that demand, which is why more patients are being treated. Every health authority has made its own plan for dealing with the growth of demand we're seeing this year, and my right honourable friend has already made additional sums available to deal with that demand.
So, the state of the NHS, a Prime Minister 25 points behind in the polls, being lambasted about the state of the NHS. The echo from the front of the Times today, just one in four people say the NHS is working. I'm not sure Jerry Sutcliffe is an MP for Bradford South might be that excited about the fact that Liverpool's had a new hospital.
Well, he talks about the Royal Liverpool Hospital, which is currently being, the version of it John Major is talking about, is literally as we speak being demolished.
Is it?
So, yeah, the iconic concrete Royal Liverpool Hospital is being torn down.
So it's no longer one of the finest.
It's no longer, well, the new one, I've never been, but is every friend of mine who's had an appointment there says it's amazing, amazing new facility. But the version John Major is talking about is literally being knocked down as we speak. So Jerry Sutcliffe might have begun by acknowledging the brand new extension, but he wouldn't get very far. It's fascinating, right? And this tells the same story that the Labour Party are sort of responding to now, which is public services at a state, or perceived to be at a state, of near total collapse. And that is basically what voters are reacting to.
Yeah, no, it's just the echo through time. We think everything is brand new, and the arguments about saying one thing in private and saying one thing in public, or the state of the NHS, or political infighting. Oh, it's all unprecedented. It's not unprecedented. Everything's happened before. Right, let's round off then with a final question from Peter Bottomley. What are the few people still an MP after all this time? He's now the father of the House.
Senior Labour officials just got in touch to say Jerry Sutcliffe is a legend, by the way. So there
we are. They're all listening. So Peter Bottomley, Conservative MP, asking a question to Prime Minister John Major.
Mr. Peter Bottomley.
Would my right honourable friend agree that one shouldn't unfairly, or even fairly, always go back to what people put in their election addresses in the 1980s, but might want to look at what they put in their election addresses at the last election, and then wonder how many of those policies they've reversed in the last 5 years?
Well, I think, Madam Speaker, it is possible possible, the fact I'm prepared to offer a prize to anyone who can find five policies that the Right Honourable Gentleman has been consistent on.
There we are. There's his last zinger. A prize to anyone who can find five policies on which Tony Blair has been consistent. It's amazing, actually. That I didn't think I'd fully appreciated just how much in that period, in the run-up to the 97 election, that Blair was accused of being all over the place and being inconsistent, saying one thing here and one thing there. And the echo, therefore the echoes were today.
One thing there, one thing here, one thing there, inexperienced, not having any substance behind the rhetoric. It is exactly the attacks you see on Keir Starmer now, levelled at Tony Blair. And even some Labour people will draw the unfavourable comparison. They'll say, look, Tony knew exactly what he wanted to do. He was so intensely political. I mean, even if that's true, even if the idea that Keir Starmer is less political than Tony Blair is true, didn't do Tony Blair much good at this point in the electoral cycle. Nobody was saying, certainly in bits of the mainstream press, were not saying, oh, Tony Blair is, you know, such a radical and interesting thinker. You know, beyond sort of Will Hutton in The Observer or whatever, most people were saying exactly the same things that are now being said about Keir Starmer.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely fascinating. Loads of you have been getting in touch. Mike says, Tony Blair did the Hopi changey thing to a T, and that's worth more than 100 well-crafted parliamentary questions. In 1997, the country were done with the Tories. They are done with them now. Out of ideas, out of road, soon to be out of office. It's interesting that, I mean, I suppose partly because it was about the debating change. It feels more like a thing that we are peering in on, the sort of argument being played out.
Exactly.
It's
a dialogue in a way that it's not just two people.
So each question isn't like, you know, restating the position and so it could all be clipped up for social media. It's a debate happening in the House of Commons, you know, in the cauldron of debate, aimed at each other and their backbenches, and which we're sort of peering in on it, which makes a slight difference. H has got a touch saying, I assume not from Steps, loving the 1997 look back. I was 3 years old then. Thank you for that. That's very good. Sarah says, we played Grandmother's Footsteps in Yorkshire too. The same game in Wales was apparently called London, which, if anything, Sarah, has confused me even more. That was Classic PMQs Unpacked, and Patrick's going to be in next week.
Me and Tim Shipman will be doing another.
You'll be doing another one of those.
Very much looking forward to it.
Fabulous. Nice to see you, Patrick. And obviously you can catch Patrick's column in The Times on Friday.
Well, that's all we've got time for today. We'll have another Classic PMQs Unpacked next week because they're off for such a long time for Easter. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.